Also, how many of you remember what movie trailers were like in the 20th century? Let's go back 25 years or so. Pretty amazing the difference between a movie trailer then and a movie trailer now. You know, today a movie trailer doesn't usually tell you very much about the actual movie, right? It just shows you like an intense sequence of scenes, and there's some intense music underneath, and it just kind of is the sensory overload for 90 seconds and makes you want to watch the movie or not. But 25 years ago, movie trailers were very different. If you go online and you find an old trailer, you'll know the entire plot to the whole movie in 90 seconds, right? These old trailers, they told you who the good guy was, who the bad guy was, what the problem was, how that problem would be resolved, how it ends. Like, in 90 seconds, you get the whole movie. And you know what? Because the trailer convinced the audience, like, that's a good story. That would be a good movie. People went and watched the whole thing anyways. Well, our passage this morning is kind of like an old movie trailer, right? Moses effectively packs the story of the next 11 chapters of Genesis into a mere 16 verses. Right off the bat, we learn who the main characters are. We learn what the plot's going to be. We even learn how this section of Genesis is going to end. It's like an old trailer to a good movie, and this preview helps us to know what the story is all about. It might be easy to get lost in the next 11 chapters of Genesis. Like, why are these things happening? You're going to see a number of different events, but this introduction frames our understanding of the story, frames our understanding of the message. So what is the message of the next 11 chapters of Genesis? Here's the main idea that we're going to see this morning. God's people are those who have been chosen by God's grace and who walk by faith in God's promises. God's people are those who have been chosen by God's grace and who walk by faith in God's promises. That's what we're going to see this morning, and that's the theme of the next 11 chapters of Genesis. Who are the people of God? Those who have been chosen by God's grace, those who walk by faith in God's promises. You can open your Bibles to Genesis 25. The story of the next 11 chapters is, of course, the continuation of a bigger story that we've been following already. That's the story of God's promises to Abraham. Last week, we looked at the first half of this chapter, and we saw that though Abraham had seven other sons, Isaac was the chosen son. Isaac was the son that God blessed. God's promises to Abraham would continue through Isaac's line, and that's where our passage this morning picks up. What we have this morning is the introduction to the story of Isaac's family. We have the introduction to Isaac's family history, and it begins with an answered prayer. An answered prayer. Let's look at verse 19. These are the generations of Isaac, Abraham's son. Abraham fathered Isaac, and Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah, the daughter of Bethuel the Aramean of Padan Aram, the sister of Laban the Aramean, to be his wife. Moses begins the story of Isaac's family by reminding us of two things that we already know. Abraham fathered Isaac, and Isaac married Rebekah. Right, this is not new information to us, but why does Moses start this way? Because now that the son of Abraham has a wife, he can have offspring, and the promises can continue through his line. Except there's a problem. Look at verse 21. And Isaac prayed to the Lord for his wife because she was barren. She was barren. Like his mother, Sarah, Isaac's wife, Rebekah, was unable to conceive. She was unable to have a child. And as long as she was unable to have a child, then God's promises to Abraham could not be fulfilled. God was going to make a great nation of Abraham. God was going to bless all the nations through his seed. And yet, the wife of the son of promise is unable to conceive. Now, when Abraham and Sarah faced this exact same situation, what did they do? They took matters into their own hands, right? They accepted Sarah's barrenness as a brute fact. And they sought another way to produce offspring for Abraham. That other way, of course, led to the birth of Isaac's older brother Ishmael, who ultimately was cast away from Abraham's household. Isaac, on the other hand, he was the miracle baby, right? His father was 100, his mother was 90. When the Lord visited Sarah and brought about his birth, he's the son of promise. And so then when Isaac and Rebekah discover that she too was barren, like Sarah, his mother, had been, what does Isaac do? He doesn't take matters into his own hands. Instead, Moses tells us that he prayed to the Lord for his wife. Isaac didn't try to intervene on God's behalf. Instead, he interceded to God on his wife's behalf. And how did the Lord respond to Isaac's faithful intercession? Look at the end of verse 21. And the Lord granted his prayer, and Rebekah, his wife, conceived. When Isaac prayed, God provided. When Isaac asked, God answered. When he appealed to God's promise, God fulfilled his promise. What took many chapters to come to fruition in Abraham's story, one verse, Isaac prayed, God answered. Now, the way this verse reads on its own might give us the impression that this answer was immediate, that God granted Isaac's prayer quickly, but how old was Isaac when he married Rebekah? We just saw he was 40 years old, right? How old was Isaac when Rebekah gave birth to their children? Moses tells us in verse 26 that he was 60 years old, right? So this means when we read that Isaac prayed to the Lord for his wife, we should understand that Isaac prayed continually for his wife for up to 20 years. The family history of Isaac begins with two decades of persevering prayer. And what does this tell us about Isaac? It tells us that Isaac, like his father Abraham, was a man of faith. He was a man of faith. This isn't to say he was always faithful. We'll see in just a few minutes that he was not always faithful. But it is to say that Isaac believed in God's promise, and he believed that God was able to fulfill his promise. And for 20 years, he prayed in faith until God brought his promise about. And this was the true evidence of Isaac's sonship. Like his father, Isaac walked by faith. What about us today? The Apostle Paul tells us in Galatians 3:7 that it is those of faith who are the sons of Abraham, right? So if we truly belong to the family of Abraham, that is, if we are truly spiritual heirs of God's promises, then like Isaac was, we will be people of faith. We will resemble the faith of our spiritual father. And church, what is the tangible evidence that we are people of faith? Well, in this passage, it's if we are people of prayer. If we're people of prayer, persevering prayer for God to fulfill his promises is one of the primary fruits of faith in those promises. And if that's the case, then consider this morning, are you bearing this fruit of faith in your life? Are you a person of prayer? As true children of Abraham, as those who share the faith of Abraham, we must persevere in praying for God to fulfill his redemptive promises. Now today, this means that by faith, we must keep on praying that the gospel will advance to the ends of the earth. It means that by faith, we must keep on praying that the church will be built up in its spiritual war. By faith, it means that we must keep on praying that Christ would return in glory to save those who are eagerly waiting for him. We hear these promises in the gospel, and we persevere in prayer for these promises to come true. If we truly belong to the family of Abraham, if this story, if his story is truly our family history, if we're a part of this, then we will be people of faith whose lives are marked by persevering prayer. It's how the family history of Isaac begins. This brings us to the second part of the story where we see a sibling rivalry. A sibling rivalry. So Isaac prayed to the Lord. And when God granted his prayer, Rebekah didn't conceive only one son, but two. She was pregnant with twins. And while this would normally be a joyful thing for Rebekah, it was going to be a painful thing. Before, during, and after their birth, her sons would be bitter rivals. Let's look first at what was happening before their birth in verse 22. The children struggled together within her. And she said, if it is thus, why is this happening to me? So, you know, when pregnancies progress, what most moms experience are these sweet little kicks from their baby, right? But when Rebekah's pregnancy progressed, she experienced the excruciating effects of a war that was taking place in her womb. The words, the children struggled together within her, could literally be translated, they were smashing against each other in the womb. The twins in Rebekah's womb are locked in a violent struggle. And this was a painful physical experience for Rebekah. She cries out, if it's thus, why is this happening to me. Of course, there's no ultrasound. She doesn't know that she has twins at this point. She just is experiencing this painful pregnancy. And one commentator translates her question, if it's like this, why am I here? She's in so much pain. She just doesn't understand how this could be a good thing. How is this worth it? In her pain and confusion, though, what does she do? Where does she turn? Look at the end of verse 22. So she went to inquire of the Lord. Just as her husband Isaac prayed to the Lord when she was barren, so now Rebekah inquires of the Lord when she is suffering. She too is a woman of faith. Now the Lord doesn't usually explain the reason for our sufferings to us, does he? But here, he gives Rebekah a direct answer to her question. Why is this happening to me? Look at verse 23. And the Lord said to her, two nations are in your womb, and two peoples from within you shall be divided. The one shall be stronger than the other. The older shall serve the younger. I think in our kids' Sunday school class for kindergartners through second grade, their memory verse this week was, he knows everything. That's right. He knows everything. Well, God knows everything, and he knows what's going on in Rebecca's womb. Long before we had ultrasound technology, the Lord reveals to Rebecca that she's pregnant with twins. He doesn't just disclose the reality of this pregnancy. He doesn't just disclose that these twins are here. He discloses their destinies. He discloses their destinies. This divine revelation explains all that we're going to see over the next 11 chapters. First, the Lord reveals that her two children will become two distinct nations. And here we need to remember God's promise to Abraham that he would make of him a great nation, right? A great nation. Well, God is revealing here that only one of Rebekah's sons will become the great nation that God promised to Abraham. The other son will become another nation, a separate nation, a different nation, a nation that is excluded from God's plan. In addition to this, God declares that the younger son will become the greater son. Here we need to remember the significant pride of place that was given to the firstborn son in ancient Near Eastern cultures. Even in the case of twins, the firstborn son would be the primary inheritor, received double what all his younger siblings would receive from their father. The natural order of things was that the younger would serve the older, but by divine decree, God reverses this natural order. The older shall serve the younger. The great nation that he has promised will be established through Isaac and Rebekah's secondborn son. That's the sibling rivalry before the birth. Now look at what happened during the birth. In verses 24 through 26, when her days to give birth were completed, behold, there were twins in her womb. The first came out all red, all his body like a hairy cloak, and they called his name Esau. Afterward, his brother came out with his hand holding Esau's heel, so his name was called Jacob. Isaac was 60 years old when she bore them. So when Isaac and Rebekah's twins were finally born, their firstborn was named for his appearance, and their secondborn was named for his actions. Now, we've had a lot of babies born at Redeemer the last few years. Some of the babies that have been born here had a lot of hair on their heads. But I don't think that anyone's baby probably had as much hair as this baby did. The description Moses provides is a little difficult to translate from Hebrew into English, but it seems that Isaac and Rebekah's firstborn was covered with red hair from head to toe. Alan Ross comments he looks more like an animal of the field than an ordinary baby. And based on this appearance, what name does he receive? Esau, which more literally, it would be hairy. Now, you might think that's unfortunate, an unfortunate name. But his younger brother doesn't fare much better. His parents name him Jacob, which literally means cheater. And why do they name him this? Because as Esau was being delivered, Jacob was born grabbing his heel, trying to get the upper hand over his brother, trying to get ahead. Kids, if you ever race your siblings, you know it's not legal in a race to pull your opponent backward. But that's exactly what Jacob is trying to do. Now Esau, he wins the race out of the womb. But Jacob is born with a determination to overtake his brother. And as we'll see, he's going to do that by any means necessary. That's the sibling rivalry during the birth, and it continued for many years after the birth. We can only imagine what it was like between these two twins as they were growing up, but Moses actually skips all of that, and he fast forwards all the way into their adult years. First, Moses tells us just how different these twin brothers ended up being. Look at verse 27. When the boys grew up, Esau was a skillful hunter, a man of the field, while Jacob was a quiet man dwelling in tents. So in other words, Esau was an outdoorsman and Jacob was a homebody, right? And while Esau could be found out in the field hunting wild animals, Jacob was usually found in a more domestic setting. There's nothing inherently superior or inferior about either of these descriptions, but it is worth noticing how they align with earlier characters in Genesis. Who else was a skillful hunter in Genesis? Ishmael was, right? And long before him, Nimrod was, the king of Babel, right? And who else was a tent dweller? Well, Abraham was, right? And Moses is including some pointers here about how these brothers will align with the seed of the serpent and the seed of the woman. These are indicators to us. Unfortunately, the differences between the brothers brought out some partiality from their parents. Look at verse 28. Isaac loved Esau because he ate of his game, but Rebekah loved Jacob. Now, we know that this is not the way parental love should work, right? In a healthy family, both parents should love all their children equally, but this was not a healthy family. And Moses doesn't whitewash that. He doesn't whitewash the fact that Isaac was partial to Esau and Rebekah was partial to Jacob. Further, Moses seems to assign the blame for this to Isaac. Notice that he only gives us Isaac's motivation for being partial to his firstborn son, Esau. He loved Esau because he ate of his game. He loved Esau because Esau made good barbecue, right? We saw earlier that Isaac was a man of faith who bore the fruit of persevering prayer. But here we learn that Isaac was also a man who craved a good meal and who preferred the son who could provide it to him. His partiality toward Esau was rooted in his love for Esau's food. On the other hand, Moses doesn't actually give us a reason for why Rebekah loved Jacob. Unlike Isaac, her love for Jacob isn't selfishly motivated. She doesn't love him because of what he can do for her. On the contrary, it seems that Rebekah loves Jacob because of what God declared about him. She knows that Jacob is the son of promise. She knows that Jacob will receive the blessing. Isaac knows this too, of course, but he ignores it. He ignores this fact and he gives preference to the son who satisfies his physical cravings. This will only get worse as the story continues and only exasperated the rivalry between these brothers. What are we to make of this section of verses? What's the point in all these details? Why does Moses tell us about how Jacob and Esau were wrestling in the womb and then they were racing into the world and then they're jockeying for their parents' affections? Like, why does he tell us all this? I believe it's because Moses is teaching us about Genesis 3:15. I will put enmity between you and the woman and between your offspring and her offspring. Right, this is part of the story. First, there was Cain and Abel. Then there was Ishmael and Isaac. And now there's Esau and Jacob. Genesis is continually telling us the story of the enmity that exists between the seed of the serpent and the seed of the woman, continually reminding us that there's a war going on between the seed of the serpent and the seed of the woman. Now, in the previous iterations of this war, we know Cain was the seed of the serpent because he murdered his brother. That's seed of the serpent material, right? We also know Ishmael was the seed of the serpent because he mocked Isaac and persecuted Isaac. But here with Esau and Jacob, twin brothers who were both sons of Isaac, who himself was the son of promise, what is it here that distinguishes one brother as the seed of the serpent and the other as the seed of the woman? It's only God's electing grace. It's only God's electing grace. Listen to how the Apostle Paul puts it in Romans 9, 10 through 12. When Rebekah had conceived children by one man, our forefather Isaac, though they were not yet born and had done nothing either good or bad, in order that God's purpose of election might continue, not because of works, but because of him who calls, she was told, the older will serve the younger. You see what Paul is saying here? He's telling us that Jacob was chosen to be the seed of the woman. Jacob was chosen to be the son of promise, not because he was good or because Esau was bad. They were chosen for this before they were born. It was because of him who calls. It was because of God's purpose of election. In other words, it was because of God's grace. And if it was because of God's grace, if it was because of God's purpose of election, then the Israelites, who would read this centuries later, had no place for boasting over the Edomites who descended from Esau, or of any other nation for that matter. As the Israelites read this, the Edomites were their enemies. Right? The Edomites were against Israel, and Israel might have been tempted to think, we're the good guys, right? We're God's people. We deserve this. They deserve God's judgment. No, this story informs them they weren't chosen because they were better or because the other nations were worse. They were chosen because God is sovereign in his grace. And the same is true for us who belong to Christ today. Why have we inherited the promises to Abraham? Why do we belong to God's people? Why are we united to Jesus Christ? Not because we're better than others. It's because before we were even born, God elected us to salvation. It is because of him who calls. Our status as God's people is entirely owing to God's sovereign grace. Our status as God's people is entirely owing to God's sovereign grace. Now we might ask this question, is this unfair? Is this unfair toward Esau? If, as Paul says, he hadn't done anything good or bad, I mean, how could God choose Jacob over him? Was God unjust to elect the one brother and not the other? Along the same lines, is God unjust to elect certain people to salvation and not all people? These questions lead us to the final part of our story this morning, where we see a foolish deal. A foolish deal. Moses sets the scene for us in verse 29. It says, once when Jacob was cooking stew, Esau came in from the field and he was exhausted. So the picture here fits what we've already heard about the brothers in verse 27, right? You have Jacob, the quiet home buddy, cooking some stew, and you have Esau, the skillful hunter, returning from a hunt. But apparently on this particular day, Esau was unsuccessful, right? Moses tells us he came back exhausted, or some translations say famished. And as for Jacob, what we're about to see is that he wasn't just cooking a bowl of stew, he was cooking up a plan, right, to capitalize on his brother's weakness. Keep reading in verse 30. And Esau said to Jacob, let me eat some of that red stew, for I am exhausted. Therefore his name was called Edom. So Esau does what any exhausted person would do when they walk into the house and they smell something good in the kitchen, right? He asks for some food. He asks his brother, can I have some of that red stew? And notice that Moses pauses here, and he makes a connection between Esau's request for red stew and the name of Esau's descendants, Edom, the Edomites. It's not just that the Edomites were descended from someone who was born covered with red hair. No, they were descended from someone who became notorious for his association with a bowl of red stew. And we're going to see why as we continue. What should Jacob have done, though, in this moment? What should Jacob have done for his exhausted brother? Your brother comes in. He's tired, he's hungry, you're cooking some food, he asked for some food. What should you do, kids? Give some food to him, right? You should have given him some stew. You should have offered him a bowl. You should have gladly served his brother in his weakness and his hunger, but look at how Jacob responds instead in verse 31. Jacob said, sell me your birthright now. Jacob tells Esau, I'm not just going to give you stew, but I'll propose a trade, right? A bowl of stew for your birthright. A bowl of stew for the rights of the firstborn. This is a terrible trade. This is a preposterous proposal, right? There was nothing more valuable in the ancient world than the birthright of the firstborn son. Jacob was demanding that Esau sell his future inheritance for a measly bowl of stew. And you'd think that Esau would just laugh in Jacob's face and say, I'll make my own stew. But look at what Esau says in verse 32. Esau said, I'm about to die. Of what use is a birthright to me? And listen, when Esau says here, I'm about to die, we should take this as literally as we take a teenage boy who comes into the house and says, I'm starving, right? You're not starving. Sure, he's exhausted, but he's also exaggerating here. He was not on death's door. He was just really hungry. And he smells the aroma of Red stew. I wish I knew what red stew was, right? Red stew wafting through the air. And his empty stomach is churning. And with these sensations coming over him, the long-term value of a distant inheritance seems irrelevant compared to the immediate satisfaction of a warm meal. Jacob doesn't just want a handshake agreement, though. He wants to make sure that this works. And so he wants a guarantee. In verse 33, he demands, "Swear to me now." He requires Esau to sell his birthright under oath, and without hesitation, what does Esau do? So he swore to him and sold his birthright to Jacob. The firstborn signs over his inheritance to the younger brother, a double portion of all that Isaac had, and what does he get in return? Verse 34, then Jacob gave Esau bread and lentil stew, and he ate and drank and rose and went his way. So in exchange for his future, Esau gets one good meal. And then he goes on his way with his day. Moses concludes the story by giving us God's perspective on the transaction. Thus, Esau despised his birthright. Thus, Esau despised his birthright. And at this point, we especially need to remember that this was not just any birthright. This wasn't just any inheritance. This was the inheritance of Isaac, the son of Abraham. This inheritance represented the very promises of God. And Esau despised it. He scorned it. He didn't value it. He treated it as if it didn't matter. In a very real sense, Esau didn't simply exchange the birthright for a bowl of soup. He exchanged God's eternal blessing for temporary pleasure. He exchanged God's eternal blessing for a moment of satisfaction. So then, was God unfair to choose Jacob instead of Esau? Was it unjust of God to elect the younger brother and not the older brother? And here's Moses' answer. Though God sovereignly chose to bless Jacob, Esau freely chose to reject God's blessing. Though God determined ahead of time that the older brother would serve the younger brother, Esau decided for himself to sell his birthright to his younger brother. God's decision to bless Jacob instead of Esau wasn't unjust. It was perfectly compatible with Esau's own choices. This reveals the mysterious relationship between divine sovereignty and human responsibility. Right? Scripture teaches us two things at the same time. Scripture teaches us that God sovereignly determines all things according to his will, and Scripture teaches us that we are responsible for the free choices that we make. Both are true. And so, for instance, God sovereignly determined before the creation of the world that he would have a plan of redemption, which means he sovereignly determined that Adam and Eve would fall into sin, and yet Adam and Eve freely chose to disobey God's command in the garden, and they were held responsible for their sin. Or later in Genesis, we'll see that while Jacob's sons chose to sell their younger brother Joseph into slavery, Joseph could say to them, "You meant it for evil, but God meant it for good." Their free choices were compatible with God's sovereign plan. Both were true. Ultimately, the mystery of divine sovereignty and human responsibility reaches a glorious crescendo in the cross of Christ. The Apostle Peter puts it this way to the religious leaders in Jerusalem in Acts 2. He says, "This Jesus, delivered up according to the definite plan and foreknowledge of God, you crucified and killed by the hands of lawless men." So the greatest evil ever committed, the crucifixion of the Son of God, was according to the definite plan and foreknowledge of God. It was God's plan and man's actions. Or to make it even more explicit, listen to what the early church prayed in Acts 4. "Truly in this city, they were gathered together against your holy servant Jesus, whom you anointed both Herod and Pontius Pilate, along with the Gentiles, the peoples of Israel, to do whatever your hand and your plan had predestined to take place." So those who gathered together against Jesus were doing whatever God's hand and God's plan had predestined. And what was God's plan? What did God predestine to take place? Not simply that his son would be crucified. No, the definite plan of God was that through the sinful actions of fallen men, God would redeem fallen men from their sin by his grace. This is the glorious mystery of God's sovereignty and human responsibility. And this brings us back to Jacob. When you go back to Jacob for a moment, clearly Esau is not the only sinner among these two brothers, right? In this story, Jacob lives up to his namesake. He capitalizes on his brother's weakness, and he secures the rights of the firstborn for himself. To his credit, he valued the birthright more than Esau did, but he definitely didn't deserve the birthright. In fact, he too deserved to be cut off from God's blessing. So why wasn't he? Why wasn't Jacob cut off? Only because of the grace of God that would be purchased for him by the true seed of the woman, the true son of promise in Jesus Christ. And church, it's only by this same grace that we have received the blessing of God's salvation today. We don't deserve it. We don't deserve the salvation of God, but because Jesus took on flesh and became our elder brother, and because he served us in our weakness, because he bore the wrath that we do deserve, we now freely share in his inheritance. Jesus shares his inheritance with us by taking what we deserve and giving what he alone truly deserves. So this morning, church, let us count this inheritance as our supreme treasure. It's our supreme treasure. The book of Hebrews, the author of Hebrews is writing to believers who are considering turning away from Christ, turning back to Judaism to avoid persecution, to secure comfort in this life. And he says, don't be like Esau. Don't be like Esau who sold his birthright for a single meal. Don't trade away the eternal blessing of God for temporary comfort, temporary pleasures. This morning, let us count the inheritance that Christ has secured for us as our supreme treasure. Reject the temporary pleasures that this world has to offer. Reject the temporary comforts of living for ourselves in favor of the inheritance that is undefiled, unfading, and kept in heaven for us. Let us despise every earthly reward for the eternal treasure of life in the presence of the God who has been unspeakably gracious to us. Let me pray for us.